Don't Depend on Daddy is an unfiltered safe space, empowering young professionals to build independence in their 20s and beyond, whether it be personal, professional, or financial. Regardless of your age, relationship status, or job title, the most consistent person in your life is you. So join me and let's build our independence together. Enjoy. Hello, and welcome back to Don't Depend on Daddy, the podcast. My name is Michaela. I am your host, and we are doing a Q&A episode today. A couple of weeks ago, at this point, I posted a Q-box on my Instagram story, and I literally got so many great money, career, business, personal questions that I'm going to answer them in a little bit more detail today. Before we get into it, as usual, we're going to go through all of our stuff. I do have a fun special announcement. So if you've been following me on Instagram, you may have seen that I recently launched an accountability group. It's called the Break Your Budget Inner Circle. And every month I host masterclasses. At least that's what I'm starting to do. So this is just the second month that we're doing it. And for the masterclass in February, I am bringing in Ankur Nagpal. He is the co-founder of Carry Money, which is an all-in-one retirement planning platform. So he's coming into the inner circle to host a masterclass all about retirement planning, retirement strategy, 401ks, IRAs, Roth IRAs, backdoor IRAs, self-employment 401ks, everything related to tax strategies, retirement planning, all that kind of stuff. So if you are interested in joining this live masterclass, it will also be recorded. You can join the Break Your Budget Inner Circle. I will have all of the masterclass details linked in the show notes. You do need to be a member of the Inner Circle to attend the class. That being said, you do not need to remain a member of the Inner Circle. I have gotten a few messages of people saying they want to come into the class, but they don't need the monthly support. That's totally fine. At any point in time in the Inner Circle, you can cancel. So you can pay to join. It's $10, so it's not crazy. You can pay to join the Inner Circle, attend the class, and then cancel if you'd like. You will not hurt my feelings. That's totally allowed. So come join us. It's February 20th at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. If you can't make it live, you still need to join to watch the recording. And I'm really excited about it. So I hope to see you in there. Housekeeping first. First things first, if you are a new listener, hello, welcome. You can use the code PODCAST1 for $10 off the Personal Finance Dashboard, which is my signature financial planning tool. All of the details on that is in the show notes, so you can just go right to the Personal Finance Dashboard sales page and pretty much figure out everything you need to know. Next, if you are interested in overhauling your finances this year, you should check out the financial planning checklist. Once you download that checklist, you will be able to go through a totally free 4-day financial planning email crash course. So go download that checklist. Again, it's linked in the show notes. And as always, if you have not ordered Own Your Money, you totally should. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Indie Books. You can also listen to it for free if you have a Spotify Premium membership. So if you're listening to this on Spotify Premium, you can also go listen to Own Your Money for free. It's also available on Kindle. And if you want to purchase the audiobook somewhere else, you can do that as well. Next, let's move into the Don't Depend on Daddy moment of the week. So the Don't Depend on Daddy moment of the week is an opportunity to share a moment of independence that either myself or one of you, the listeners, have exemplified. So if you're interested in submitting your Don't Depend on Daddy moment of the week, there is a form also, again, linked in the show notes, as is everything. And you can go in and let me know. And depending on, you know, whether I'm sharing my own or someone else's, it could be featured anonymously, of course, in the episode. So today I am highlighting a Don't Depend on Daddy moment of the week from a listener submission. And it's a little bit long, so I'm going to read through it. This one says, I have had struggles recently in my living situation. My husband and I moved out of state away from family so he can go to his dream school, but our apartment hasn't been ideal and my mom has been having issues being independent on her own, so she's moved in with us. Given everything and indecision with what I want to do with my life, I've taken advice from Michaela to develop routines and make meaningful upgrades. The two biggest upgrades that make me so happy is I bought a salad spinner and a new shower head. The salad spinner has made me more motivated to make salads for myself and my family, and it's really fun. With the shower head, I replaced our crummy apartment one with a rainfall one, and it has incredible water pressure and makes me want to consistently take showers and do more work towards my self-care and hygiene. It's honestly made such a difference to get me out of a depressive slump. Thanks, Michaela, for being so inspiring and carving out an online space to showcase independence in early adulthood. I really loved this Don't Depend on Daddy moment of the week submission because it highlights how a few very simple small upgrades, so like a new salad spinner and a shower head, can actually have such a positive impact on your life just in the way that you show up for yourself. It doesn't need to take a lot to show up for yourself, to change your habits, to improve your day-to-day life. And I just thought that this was a really good example of small, subtle things that you can do or a small, subtle upgrade you can make in your life to just overall feel better. If you feel better, you'll make better decisions, and that ultimately has a huge ripple effect on the rest of your life. So I really liked that Don't Depend on Daddy moment of the week. Don't forget, you can submit yours via the form in the show notes. Now, we're going to move into the bulk of this episode, which is the Q&A. Basically, what I did was I pulled 5 questions across the 3 categories: money, personal finance, career, business, and then personal. We'll do personal at the end. And I'm just going to go through and basically freeball these questions. If you ever want to submit a question for the show, make sure you're following Break Your Budget and Don't Depend on Daddy, because that's where I submit these Q boxes. And those are that is really your only opportunity to submit questions. I don't have like an email form or anything for questions for the podcast. So with that, let's just get right into it. We're going to start with the money category. So the first question here is, how long did it take you to change your behavior on unnecessary spending? I really liked this question because I think that unnecessary or impulse spending is something that most of us struggle with, myself included. I used to be on the spectrum where I would underspend and I wouldn't buy anything. And I would say I've never really been like a super impulse spender either. And I fall now right in the middle. The big thing, there are 2 big things that help me with this. First being implementing weekly money routines. So obviously this isn't new, but every single week I sit down, I go through my weekly money review, I track my expenses. This accomplishes 2 things. One, it makes me really understand what I am spending my money on. And 2, it forces me to self-reflect on how I feel about it, because as you go through the process of actually plugging in the numbers, it does actually force you to like really acknowledge, okay, I spent X amount of dollars on something. How do I feel inputting this? And how do I feel looking at the bigger picture? And if you don't like the way you feel, that will inadvertently influence your behavior going forward, because you know that you're holding yourself accountable the next week to go in and plug things in. You don't want to feel the same way. So the weekly money review helped me a ton. And I would say that after doing that consistently for like a month or two, I pretty much totally changed my spending behavior. But through that process, we're getting into the other big catalyst here, it helped me understand my values and priorities with my spending. So because I knew what I was actually spending my money on, I could look at those numbers and look at the what and be like, okay, I spent $50 at the bar last night. I did not have a good time and I don't feel good today. I no longer want to be spending my money in that way. Instead, I would rather spend that money on going to the farmer's market, going out for lunch with one of my friends, going out to buy coffee, doing actually like literally anything else, and redirecting what you're spending your money on as a result of understanding how spending your money on certain things makes you feel is how you figure out the values and priorities and like what you want to prioritize your spending on. And once you know what your spending priorities are, it's a lot easier to avoid unnecessary spending and like spending that doesn't make you feel good. So the long story long answer to this question is, it took me a couple of months, I would say like 1 to 3 months is a good gauge on changing your spending behavior, so long as you're going through a weekly money review and you're using those weekly money reviews to A, self-reflect on your spending behavior and how it makes you feel, and B, slowly begin to identify what your spending value categories are so you can better prioritize the money that you are spending on things that add value to your life. So that's question number 1. Moving on to the next question, how to invest when you're early in your career. I get a lot of questions around how to invest and different time periods for when to invest. So in this one, like early on in your career. First things first, if you didn't listen to last week's episode, I did a whole investing episode with Austin Hankwitz, so you should definitely go back and listen to that for just general investing knowledge. When you're early in your career, I'm going to guess that you're young, so you're like a new grad, you have more time to invest your money. So the principle is the more time you have for your money to grow in the market, and like the younger you are, the more risk you can absorb. So your risk tolerance is a little bit higher. So that means that you can invest a little bit more aggressively. By aggressively, I mean predominantly in like ETFs, stocks, mutual funds, as opposed to bonds, which are a much safer way to invest your money. Again, go listen to the episode to better understand all of this. So if you're early in your career, I would prioritize investing in ETFs, mutual funds. Pretty much all of my investments are in mutual funds and ETFs. I don't do any individual stock investing. And also to prioritize retirement and 401k investing. So if you have 401k or a 401k offered through your employer, make sure you're investing into your 401k at least up to the match. Generally speaking, this is not advice, but a lot of people will invest in target date funds in their 401ks. That's what I do in my 401k. I'm in a 2060 target date fund. That automatically rebalances my investments from the phase of I'm in right now to be like higher stocks, lower bonds, a higher allocation of stocks and a smaller allocation of bonds. And then as I get closer to 2060, which is that target retirement date, it automatically changes or like rebalances the portfolio to be more bonds, less stocks to sort of help protect the growth. So if you're investing in a 401k, explore target date funds. And then beyond a 401k, you know, you can explore a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA to help boost your retirement savings in addition to your 401k. And then if you'd like to invest beyond retirement, you can explore a brokerage account. I think brokerage accountants get villainized because they don't have the same tax advantages as retirement accounts. But because they don't have those same tax advantages, you do have more access to that money and you can put more money into it. So I do think that a brokerage account does play a part in a, like a broader investment strategy as a young professional and really at any point in your life. If you want to invest money for a future date that you want to access before retirement, because all the money you put into your retirement accounts, you really can't touch until you're 65, which is a long ways away. So if you want to invest and have money to access, you do need to explore brokerage investing. So again, go back to the other podcast episode for more information on this. The next question here is, if I had $10,000 to invest, what would I invest it in today? I thought this question was interesting because I think that somebody, the person who submitted this, would imagine I have like a really groundbreaking answer. If I was given $10,000 to invest into something, I literally would just dump it into my solo 401k, into a target date 2060 fund, and I would move on. And the reason why I would do that is because the more money you have invested at an earlier point in time into these types of accounts, so like if you can build up your 401k or your brokerage account into as big as possible the earlier you are, as you move through life, that account will grow exponentially without you needing to contribute as much to it. So I think a lot of people would consider like, oh, maybe I would buy a house or something. But I just think that padding these investment accounts as early as possible, in my opinion, for my goals in my life, based off of what I know, is the most optimal strategy in deployment of that money. I think investing in real estate, which the last two questions are around houses, investing in real estate or buying a house is great, but the utility of your cash when you are young goes further, in my opinion. This isn't a blanket statement, but just in my opinion, when you're investing through like retirement or brokerage accounts. What I would choose if I wasn't putting it into a retirement account, into my like 2060 target date fund, I would probably just put it into an S&P 500 ETF, so VOO in my brokerage account. And again, I would literally move on. Like I would not do anything crazy with it because I want that money to cook as long as possible in the stock market because it has, in my opinion, a higher potential to grow. Next, is, what is the best saving tool for a house? So saving up money for a down payment for a home is kind of a confusing, it's confusing and it's not, right? Because, you know, you need to figure out, A, how much money you would need for a down payment and what type of home you want to buy and when. But B, where to park that money so that it's not just stagnating, but also so you can access it. Oftentimes people think that, you know, if I'm going to save up for a home, I'll invest that money so it can grow. The challenge is if you're going to be buying a home in the next like less than 5 years, or that's your plan, if you invest that money, there is always the opportunity for, or the chance, I won't call it an opportunity, there's always a chance that at the time that you need to access that, the stock market is down, in which case you would have to sell at a loss. You may not have as much money available to you at that point as you have actually invested. So you really want to protect that money if you're planning to buy a home in the short term. So there are two main options that I think are great. They may not be the only options, but this is what I'm doing for saving up for a future real estate purchase at the moment, is I have a CD. So a CD is a certificate of deposit. And basically what you do with that is you can choose to essentially lock up your money for a defined period of time. So mine is a 9-month CD because I was just sort of testing it out. And the interest rate on the CD is 5.5%. So I put $10,000 into that CD. And at the end of the 9 months, which is going to be, I think in a few months, I put it in there in August. So and before the summer, I will get that $10,000 back plus 5.5%. So the challenge with the CD is because I put the $10,000 there, I cannot touch that money. So let's imagine you have a lump sum of money that you've saved over time and you know you're not going to buy a house this year. Then exploring a CD for 9 months, 12 months, 6 months, whatever, they all have different terms, with a guaranteed interest rate could be a great option. You just have to know for sure that you don't want to touch that money in that period of time, because then you'll have to pay a fee on it. It kind of like negates the whole purpose of it. If you are actively saving up, meaning you're contributing month to month and you may be buying a house and you don't know when, it could be sometime this year, sometime next year, you're not 100% sure, a high yield savings account at the moment is a great option because the interest rates are like 4 to 4.5%. So that money is still accessible because it's just in like a savings account that you have access to, but it's earning a higher yield. So you can put money into it. It's earning that 4 to 4.5% depending on the account that you choose, and you can access it at any time. This is better than just a regular savings account for this kind of money, because if you were just keeping it in a regular savings account, it's literally just sitting there. It's not earning any interest. But in the high yield savings account, you're getting a little bit of interest, maybe not as much as if you were to invest it potentially, but you don't know that for sure. You know exactly how much interest you're going to be getting back on it, and it's still cash, it's still accessible. So you're not going to lose any money there. So those would be my two options for savings tools for a house, a high yield savings account or a CD. I use Ally Bank for both. So my savings account, or my high yield savings account, is with Ally Bank, and the CD that I opened is also with Ally Bank. I do have a free high yield savings account guide. It's always linked in the show notes, so you can go check that out. If you can't find it, just go to breakyourbudget.com/links and scroll down. So that's my answer for that. And then the last money question here that I'm going to answer is, how large of a down payment do you recommend putting on a house? And I'm going to preface this with, I have not ever purchased real estate in my life, and this is just what I would do. So do with that what you will. When I make a real estate purchase, which I don't know when it will be, I will be putting 20% down. There is no argument, any information that anybody could give me that will change my mind on that, because A, if you put less than 20% down, you're paying private mortgage insurance. So it's called PMI. It's usually an extra $100 to $200 a month on top of your mortgage, interest, and home insurance, and you're also paying PMI. And on top of that, generally, I've seen, I don't know if this is the absolute truth because I am not a real estate expert, broker, whatever, but usually when you put less money down, the interest rate on your loan is a little bit higher. So I would prefer to put more money down, take on less debt, so a smaller mortgage, not pay PMI, and secure the absolute lowest interest rate on the loan as possible. Like, I know people will disagree with this, but if I could buy a house cash, I would buy a house cash. Like, I do not want to be taking on debt, even if it's good debt, which is a mortgage. I do not want to be paying interest. I want to reduce the amount of interest that I pay. And so I would prefer to put more money down. So I will be putting at least 20% down on a home purchase. And honestly, if I'm in a position, depending on, you know, the timing, the home, the interest rates, whatever, I'd even put down more. And yeah, honestly, I think that's all I'm going to say about this, because people lose their damn minds when you talk about buying a home online. And so, yeah, that's what I would do. Next, career business. So I have 5 questions here about like career switches and a few on side hustle stuff. So question number 1, what would be your best tip for a career switch or a career change? I have a few here. So first is to focus on highlighting your transferable skills when making the career switch. So for me, I spent the first 2.5 to 3 years, I think 3 years, of my career working in a very specific subset of finance, more investment related. And then I switched into FP&A, financial planning and analysis. So both were within finance, but they required very different skill sets. And when I was making that switch, on my resume, I specifically highlighted transferable skills that I learned in the investment industry to actual tactical things that I would be potentially doing in an FP&A job based off of the job description, in a way that made it look like, okay, I know I may not have this specific industry knowledge or like specific knowledge of this role based off of my prior experience, but I've exemplified XYZ skills that could be and are applicable to this particular role. So really think about transferable skills from the current role you're in and the future role that you want to be in. And you can do that by task tracking, auditing the work you're currently doing, and getting super clear on what exactly you do on a regular basis. And then B, looking at the job descriptions of the roles that you are applying to and essentially filling that gap, or thinking of examples of how you could fill that gap based off of projects or work you've done in the past. So transferable skills is huge. Second is to network, which I know is like probably an annoying thing to say, but letting people know that you're looking for a new job, reaching out for a coffee chat, talking to people, understanding what, you know, the actual work is that you would be doing with no strings attached, no expectations is key. If people know that you're looking for a new job, there's a much higher likelihood that they'll stick their neck out for you or send you an opportunity if it comes up. Don't be shy. Don't be afraid to let people know. You can also, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend posting it on your LinkedIn, but like leverage LinkedIn as a tool to network. So reach out to people who have, you know, similar roles or in roles that you are looking to apply for to understand what they're doing, or talk to people at the companies that you're targeting. So don't be afraid to network. And then the last thing here is to be okay with the lateral move. I think a big issue that people run into when it comes to career switches is they're afraid that they have to start over. You don't necessarily need to start over, but you may not be able to get into the next level up for a little bit longer. So don't be afraid if you want to do something a little bit different to sidestep instead of step forward. Lateral moves are totally fine, especially if you are trying to get into either a new industry or just a different type of role, because you do have to learn. There will be that knowledge gap and you can't expect to get paid for something you don't know how to do. So be okay with lateral moves, and it's okay if you spend a year or two sidestepping before you're stepping forward, because you have to understand the baseline skills. Okay, the next question here is, how do you know when to move to a new role? I think there are a few indicators here. First being the most obvious, if you feel like you are being disrespected or you don't like the team you're working on, you don't like your manager, it could be time to make a move. I think the other indicator here would be when you feel stuck or stagnant and like the majority of what you're doing daily is boring or not challenging, or you feel like you're not getting new work where you're actually learning something. When it comes to working at any job, you should either be learning or earning. So if you are not making crazy money and like using this period of time to build up your savings or your financial foundation, then you need to actually be using the time at work to learn stuff so that you can move your career forward. Skills are how you grow in your career. You have to have skills and you have to be able to like grow your network and have opportunities to learn. So if you're not learning, then it's time for a new role. And when you want to get a new role, it doesn't necessarily need to be an entirely new job. It could be a new role in the same company. It could be a lateral move where maybe you're doing similar type of work, but for a different vertical in the company so you can learn different, you know, industry knowledge or something of the sort. But I think the big catalyst here, outside of the obvious being disrespected, is when you're not actually growing in your knowledge or skills. Which leads into the next question, which is, do you think focusing on industry knowledge education or skill education is most important? I think that skill education in the current job market and direction we're moving in is significantly more important than like industry or, you know, educational knowledge, to make that clear distinction. I will say, obviously, I don't know your life, and I know that there are certain industries or job paths where pursuing higher education or graduate education is required to even get a job or be considered for that kind of job. So that is a different conversation. But in terms of just like a run-of-the-mill corporate job where you're working maybe in like finance or tech or project management or marketing or something of the sort, again, don't misinterpret what I'm saying here. Skills are significantly more important than like going back to school in those types of jobs. You're way better off focusing on developing monetizable skills, either directly related to your role or honestly outside of your role, because you can use those and leverage them to get higher paying jobs. So for example, for me, I'll use myself as the example here. I focused on my career in finance for a long time. And in every job, I was trying to learn more about the financial industry, investments, all that kind of stuff. That was really good and great for that particular era of my life, I guess. But it wasn't until I got into FP&A, which in my opinion is a much more transferable job career path, that I learned that there is actually so much more that I could be learning to be able to access or get different types of jobs throughout my career. And that's why I was like, okay, skills are more important. I also learned this through building up Break Your Budget as my side hustle. So at work, I was learning financial skills, so understanding a P&L, you know, understanding how to forecast, understanding different variance analysis, putting together presentations, just basic financial stuff, financial analyst type of work. But through Break Your Budget, I was learning copywriting, I was learning email marketing, I was learning social media marketing, and now I have a way more diverse skill set where if I were to go back to a job, I could very much so leverage all of these different types of skills to get a variety of types of jobs. I could go back to working in finance. I could work in marketing. I could work in social media. Like, I just have so many more skills now where, sure, maybe I could have gone back to school, but the ROI on going back to school for these kinds of jobs to like get more education and spend, you know, a couple $100,000 getting an MBA or something wouldn't have been the best utility for my time or money, as opposed to developing these skills on my own. And there are ways to learn and develop skills outside of the workplace that are more formal. Like, you can do certificates, you can do classes, you can do trainings that don't require you to go back to school necessarily. And I think the cost of those is obviously much more affordable and efficient. So if I were to focus on anything, I would definitely focus on skills specifically. I have a friend who, her boyfriend recently went to like a coding boot camp, and he did a complete career switch where he used to work in like construction management or something, went to coding boot camp for 3 months, and now he is a software engineer. So he didn't need to go back to school. He didn't need to focus on broader, you know, engineering education, software engineering education. Outside of that coding bootcamp, learned the skill in 3 months, got an entirely new job. So skills, in my opinion, trump broader education. And I honestly do think too, a lot of jobs now, a college degree is required, but it's not, or not required, encouraged, but not required is what I was trying to say. So yeah, that's my thought on that. Again, if you disagree, that's totally fine, but that's just how I feel. Number four, How to navigate side hustle options. I feel like there's so many to choose from. I talk about this in my upcoming book, Own Your Career, which I should have more details on the availability of that book, like hopefully sometime in the next month on the actual pub date. I don't know for sure what it's going to be because we're still in the final stages of everything, but I should hopefully know soon. So I'm excited to make that announcement. But I do talk about this at length, like for the second half of the book. There are two types of side hustles that you can choose from if we're going to categorize them. Low to no skill based side hustles, which they don't require no skills at all, but the purpose of that is you don't have to learn something new. These would be side hustles where maybe you have a little bit less time or you don't want to devote upfront time to like starting a business of sorts, where you leverage a third party, so an Uber, a Rover, an Instacart, to pick up hours and, you know, make additional money. So that would be a low to no skill side hustle. In that instance, I would say go with that. If you don't, again, you don't want to do upfront time to build a business. You want to make some money right away. You have maybe a couple hours a week and you just want to essentially be able to pick up some extra cash when you have the time. If you have a goal to potentially start a side hustle that you want to turn into a full-time job, or, you know, maybe it's something where you want to quit your corporate job of the sort, I would say go with a skill-based side hustle, which is the type of side hustle where you are monetizing a specific skill. So Break Your Budget is a skill-based side hustle because I had the skill of, you know, Excel templates or whatever, where I monetized it via digital downloads. And I learned about social media where I monetized that skill. Budgeting, I monetized teaching people that. So think about if you have a skill and you want to put a little bit, it requires a little bit more time. So you'd have to put more time up front into this before you actually make money. But it could have the potential to turn into more of a full-time job where with the non-skill side hustle, your income is sort of capped at the amount of time that you can commit to it. And you likely can't make a real living on doing that full time. Maybe you could, but I think for many people, it would be a lot harder. So that is how I would think about choosing a side hustle. The main factors to summarize here would be time commitment, urgency of making money, and ultimate goal of starting it. Do you just want to pick up extra cash or do you want it to be something that turns into like a real full time job? The last question here is related to different ways that I monetize Break Your Budget, which is the most successful. So when it comes to starting a side hustle or business, there are so many different ways that you can monetize. And now I'm talking specifically about skill-based side hustles. So I monetize Break Your Budget a few different ways. I'm trying to diversify this as well throughout this year. So first is through my course and template sales. So the personal finance dashboard, the 4-week financial plan, the Own Your Career template, those are sort of my big bread and butter kind of templates and courses. That is my most lucrative revenue stream, I guess. Like I would say in 2020, and the percentages have sort of changed, but in 2022, it was about 50% of my revenue. In 2023, it was like 60 to 65% of my revenue. And the remainder of my revenue came from working with brands and brand partnerships. So that's another big way that I make money. As I'm thinking going into 2024, I feel like I've mentioned this, a big goal of mine is to sort of move away from doing lots of branded partnerships and sponsorships and really monetize Break Your Budget my own way, because I just like don't want to rely on brand deals. And honestly, working with brands has become really frustrating and annoying just because I do a lot of finance branded content and it's just a lot harder for me. So I'm focusing on building up my own business, which I have a few different things that I'm doing this year. Maybe I'll talk about at a later date. Another way that I'm beginning to monetize this year, there are two other avenues, I guess. First is through business coaching. So I do take on some side hustle business clients. I don't know if I'm going to be doing this long term just because the time commitment is really high, but I do make a small amount of money by doing that. And then I've also started my accountability membership, which you should join if you haven't yet, where, you know, it's basically like a resource group for money reviews, office hours, questions, additional support with me. And every Monday we do live office hours, so you can get on the phone with me and ask your questions. We do our weekly money reviews together. We have master classes in there. So next week, if you're listening to this when this goes live, on February 20th, we're doing a retirement planning masterclass crash course. So if you want to join that, you do have to be inside the accountability group. That is also linked on my links page. So you should definitely check that out if you'd like to join. And that is really my goal with that, is to foster community in a different way for people who are seeking additional accountability and support. So I'm not making a ton of money from it at this point in time, but my ultimate goal is to build that up as more of a recurring revenue source for my business. So those are the different ways that I monetize. My most successful, to answer the question point blank, is my templates and courses. I think that that really has changed my business a lot while simultaneously helping people. That is also my favorite way to make money, because it feels like something that I actually do and have my hands on is helping other people in their lives. It's the gift that keeps on giving in more ways than one. So those are the ways that I monetize my business and which one is most successful. Now we are going to move into the personal portion of this. I have 5 more questions to answer. So the first question here is, what are your personal non-finance and non-career goals for this year? My biggest goal this year is to make more friends and to be more social and really to like widen my net, specifically making more girlfriends. I would love to have a bigger group of girls to hang out with, specifically ones who are interested in not going out to bars and stuff. I'm just kind of over it. Not to say I'll never go, but it's not something that I want to be spending a lot of my time doing. And I also just want to have, again, more friends, more creator friends is a big one. I feel like I have a good group of friends already in LA, but at the same time, last year I didn't really put a ton of effort into making more friends. I really just fostered the relationships I had, which was lovely and great. But this year I really want to continue to widen the net so that I feel like I have A, more options, but B, just have more relationships in my life. The other big goal for me this year is I would like to get a boyfriend. I really am ready for a relationship. I've had a very hard time dating and like finding someone who is on my level, who's also serious, who I also am like attracted to. It's very difficult. I don't think it's necessarily specific to Los Angeles. I've thought about like, oh, if I lived in a different city, would it be easier? I really don't think so. I think that dating is hard anywhere you go. I think in LA, there are just a lot more people, a lot of different types of people. And I don't want to say I have a very specific type of person I'm necessarily looking for, because I'd like to keep my mind open. The challenge with LA is there's a lot of people who are like on the spectrum of dating, in the sense of, you know, they're open to all types of people, where I'm straight. Like I want to date a man who is a man. I don't think that that's an unreasonable request. And I also would like to date somebody with a job, which is also kind of, I won't say it's challenging, but there's like a lot of different career avenues people take in LA. A lot of aspiring actors, singers, comedians, whatever. And like, I don't want to date someone who doesn't have a full-time job. That's a boundary for me. That's not to say if you are someone out there who doesn't, that, you know, you are lesser than. It's just at the point of life that I'm in, I'm looking for someone who is fully male and has a job, who also doesn't disgust me. Challenging, very challenging. So that is another goal of mine this year. And hopefully it comes to be. The more I talk about it, we're putting it out into the universe. I feel like I've wanted to be in a relationship for a while, and I've never actually voiced that, like, that is a want that I'm allowed to have. And so I'm voicing it. I would like to have a boyfriend this year. Those are my two, and like a boyfriend who I can actually take seriously as like a potential long-term partner. I think, to clarify, I guess if I wanted to have just like a boyfriend, I could have one. It's not due to lack of interest into me. It's really been reciprocated interest from my side as well. It's very challenging. So yeah, hopefully we're speaking it into the universe, and podcasters will be the first to know if my relationship status changes. Next, how to start making your own bread. So I've been in my bread baking era this year. And really, I think people think making bread is a lot harder than it actually is. I just use the New York Times No Knead bread recipe. And it's very, very simple. I use a KitchenAid because I got one for Christmas, but you do not need to use a KitchenAid. I made plenty of bread up until, you know, the end of last year without my KitchenAid. But basically, I just, you know, you bloom the yeast, which is really easy. You just put a teaspoon of yeast and 1.5 cups of water into a cup. And then I, you know, put the flour in the KitchenAid, mix it all up with the mixer. You let it sit and rise for a few hours, and then you bake it. You do need to have, maybe you don't, but I have never made bread without a Dutch oven. So I would definitely get a Dutch oven. You can get one at Home Goods. They're not super expensive if you just want like a run-of-the-mill Dutch oven. If you want to splurge, obviously you can get like a Le Creuset or something of the sort. But mine is like a mid-tier Dutch oven. It works perfectly great. I love it. And it's very, very easy to start making your own bread. I have tried to get onto the sourdough train. My mom gave me some of her dehydrated sourdough starter, and I just could not bring it back to life. So I'm on the hunt currently for some sourdough starter, in which case that will be a whole new journey for me. But yeah, that is how I started making my own bread. It's really, really easy. I think once you make it one time, you realize like, oh, that was so not a big deal. So I do have a video on my Don't Depend on Daddy Instagram page about how I've been making my bread. So go watch that if you're interested, and make sure you're following that Instagram. The next question is related to cosmetic surgery and my nose job, which I've talked about on here a handful of times. Not in a lot of detail, so I'll give a little bit of detail on it right now just for context. But the question is, can you go into financial detail on your rhinoplasty? The long story short is, growing up, I didn't like my nose. I got made fun of for my nose, and I reached a point in my 20s. I was 24 when I got it done where, you know, I just wanted to get a nose job. Like, there was no medical reason for me to need one. It was entirely cosmetic, and I had saved up some money, and I just wanted to do it. So I finally bit the bullet. I got my nose done by Dr. Waleed Izzat at Boston Medical Center in Boston. Highly, highly, highly recommend. He was wonderful. And yeah, that was basically the story of my nose job. I paid for the nose job $9,000 total, which I honestly think is a steal. $7,000 of that was the plastic surgeon fee, and $2,000 of that is like the operating room anesthesia fee. That total $9,000 included everything. So all of my imaging, all of my appointments, pre-op, post-op, follow-up appointments, everything. I also did get a revision about a year and a half after the original surgery, which I got done right before COVID. I got it done February 2020. So now it's been about 4 years. And then a year and a half later, when I went in for like my final follow-up appointment, the doctor wasn't like super happy with the way that my tip sort of came together, because it does take a full year to 18 months for all of the swelling in your nose to completely go down. So at that point, like, the swelling had basically all gone down, and he wasn't happy with the way the tip looked. So I got a revision, which was also included in that $9,000. I didn't have to pay any more for that. So, yeah, and I'm very happy with the result, and it has completely changed my confidence. It's completely changed the way that I see myself. I say this sincerely, I do not think that Break Your Budget would be or would have been successful had I not gotten that surgery done, because I did not like the way that I looked. I didn't feel pretty. I didn't feel confident. And obviously, I'm on video all the time. And so if I always had to see video of my side profile and I didn't like the way that it looked, then I don't think I would have continued to do it. And so if you are someone who is considering cosmetic surgery, plastic surgery of the sort, and it's something that you want to change about yourself that you have wanted to change for a long time, not something that's like a result of, oh, you saw someone on TikTok get something done and now you want it. I'm talking about like a deep-seated insecurity that you've had for your whole life. Like, my nose was something that it was a lifelong journey for me. I highly recommend doing it and paying what it costs to get it done. Definitely do your research on like your surgeon and everything, but my nose job changed my life. I have, you know, again, touched on this on Instagram. People were like so rude to me, which is annoying, but do whatever the fuck you want. Like, and I think people who are critical of the way that you look or comment on whether or not you get plastic surgery are insecure losers who need to go get a life. So if you want to get something done, I am a full supporter of changing things that you want to do. And again, if that like bothers you, this isn't the space for you. So respectfully, bye. Moving on. Question number four, what is your zodiac sign? So I have co-star. I am a Cancer sun, a Gemini rising, and a Scorpio moon. I have read my co-star. I do feel like it's accurate for me. I definitely am a Cancer through and through. And I do think that my rising sign is accurate. And I do think that my moon sign is accurate. I am very like emotional, I would say. And I do feel like I have a little bit of Gemini in me for sure. So that is my chart. If you have thoughts, opinions, let me know. I'm very interested in astrology. LA has done that to me. And I think it's really cool to like learn about your zodiac chart. I don't read my horoscope every day. I read my horoscope every month though, because I'm always curious, but I definitely am into astrology. And the last question here before we wrap up is, what's your favorite type of entertainment, movies, TV, stand-up, theater, etc.? So entertainment-wise, meaning like, do I watch TV or movies? I'm not into shows. I don't have any shows that I've been watching lately. Sometimes I get hyper-fixated on shows. So I have shows in the past that I've enjoyed. Like my favorite show of all time is Grey's Anatomy. I also love the show White Collar. Those are like my top two favorite shows. I've watched all of the seasons all the way through more than once. I love White Collar. My issue with TV, I don't really have any movies that I watch. Like I'm not a movie person. I'll go to the movie theater occasionally on Tuesdays, at least here. AMC does Budget Tuesday. So it's like $8 instead of like $20 or something. So I'll go to the movies occasionally. I would say like once a month, maybe, but I don't really watch movies like at home in my free time because I'm not subscribed to the subscription stuff. So like, I don't have Netflix. I have Hulu, but I don't really watch it because I don't feel like Hulu has lots of good options. And I have Amazon Prime, but I also don't feel like the options on there are like super awesome. So yeah, I don't really watch a lot of TV or movies. I do like stand-up. I'd like to go to more comedy shows, but all the comedy shows in LA are over in like Hollywood, WeHo area. And that's just so far away from me. So it's not something that I'm doing often. I don't like the theater. You will not catch me going to a play or show of that sort unless the tickets are free and I have actually nothing else to do. If I am watching something on TV, I usually watch podcasts. So my favorite podcast right now is Brooke and Connor Make a Podcast. I'm subscribed to their close friends, so I watch both of those every week. I also like the Brittany Broski podcast. I've been watching Obsessed with Brooke, which I also really like. And otherwise, like I read a lot, I cook a lot, like I don't really spend a lot of time sitting on the couch. If I am sitting on the couch, I'm either on TikTok or I'm reading my book or I'm watching a podcast or like YouTube in the background. So that's sort of how I fill my time of that sort. But otherwise, like I have hobbies and stuff, like I'm getting out of the house. I am going to do a whole podcast episode on all of my hobbies, but I'm trying actively to like not be spending a lot of time watching TV and stuff. So yeah, that's my answer to that. Anyways, I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast episode. If you are enjoying the show, please go leave me a positive review. If you have critical or constructive feedback, it would mean the world to me if you could send me that via DM or via the feedback form rather than on a public medium like a podcast review. So please be an adult with a brain and send that to me privately. Don't do it publicly because that's just so annoying. Anyways, again, I hope you enjoyed and I'll catch you next week. Bye.